Hi, this is Lauren Milberger, and I guess if you're listening to this when we drop it, happy Valentine's Day.
Indeed, happy Valentine's Day. I'm Trav Esty, who Lauren has very graciously decided to host on this special day. Though we're recording this a few weeks earlier than Valentine's Day, we're recording it on National Spouses Day, and this year happens to mark the centennial year of the great American comedy team who were also a famous pair of spouses and a great love story for Valentine's Day. And of course, we're talking about George Burns and Gracie Allen.
Yay!
So, you know, Lauren, I think of you as the specialist and me as the generalist in this
story. You. That's an honor for you to say that.
More steeped in them than me. But I was thinking maybe a good format would be like I fire you the hardballs and softballs, and you can do more of the talking if you're up for it.
Absolutely up for it. You know, I spent a lot of time in dusty libraries and the Paley Center and the Performing Arts Library at Lincoln Center all by myself. And so it's always a joy to have someone ask me anything about my research, because I feel like I've found some really interesting things that aren't public knowledge that I just really want to share with people.
So very cool. Yeah.
Very, very happy to oblige.
You know, we could assume that listeners know something about our topic for today based on the fact that they're listening at all, attracted by how we, you know, put it out there. But just in the remote chance that we have some listeners who don't know who George Burns and Gracie Allen are, maybe we could talk a little bit about just who they were in the first place.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, I guess the short version of it is George Burns and Gracie Allen were a vaudeville team in the 1920s and 30s, who then went on to become a very famous radio team. At one point, Gracie Allen was the most popular and probably famous woman on radio. Her as a comedic woman precedes Lucille Ball, even though eventually, you know, Lucille Ball did start on radio. I'm sure some people are familiar with that. She really couldn't have done it without Gracie. And then eventually, when she passed away, I think more people will know George Burns for his later career by himself as a solo act. But originally, she was the more famous of the two. She was considered the funny one. And eventually they were a comedy team. They fell in love. They got married. And so they were a partnership on stage as well as off stage. And then eventually they did do a TV series before she retired because of heart issues.
Yeah, that's right. And some films. They weren't huge film stars, but they were in some movies too.
Yes, and with some major movie stars, I would say. But yeah. I don't think that's what most people today would know them from.
No, not
at
all.
If I mentioned International House or...
Right, big broadcast.
Maybe some people might know Damsel in Distress because it's on TCM a lot. And obviously, you know, big names in that.
And they know old George from Oh God and stuff like that.
Yes.
Going in style.
But the last movie they did together was Honolulu, which I don't have the date in front of me at the moment. But at one point, you know, when they had kids and they had... I think a lot of people don't realize that radio shows had about 40 episodes a year.
That's a lot.
It wasn't, I mean, today we go, 22 episodes of television. Wow. You know, and most streaming are doing 8 or 10. But that's one thing when I first started, as much as a huge television and radio fan as I am, I think I didn't realize that that's what they were doing. It's amazing.
Yeah. So since we're at the centennial of their vaudeville debut, one thing I thought might be a little interesting to talk about, it's a little bit of a digression, but it's it's a cool fact for people who know the team but don't know the whole story, was that, you know, we think of her as the funny one and him as the straight man when they were a team. But very briefly in the beginning, they tried it the other way around to try and picture what that might be. You could think of Jack Benny, whose birthday is also today.
That's February 14th. We should mention that. Happy birthday,
Jack. Jack and Mary Livingston. She was the straighter one. Or, you know, like in The Honeymooners or Laurel and Hardy, where the wives are the straight ones and the comedians are the funny ones. it seems like George and Gracie tried it that way for a little while, right?
Yeah, I think longer than most people realize, at least a year, if maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, I hadn't known it was that long.
One thing you'll learn, and it's sort of really kind of lovely as a playwright to write a play about them, because you can come upon a story in their life and have about five different versions of it. I mean, I'm digressing a little, hyperbolizing a bit, yeah. But... he told the same story in many different ways, in many different formats over years. And you could say it's his age, but I think that many people would say that George Byrne loved what was called sort of putting a vaudeville shine to it. That he loved show business so much and he loved storytelling that he would rather tell a good story than tell the truth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which is show business, relate, right? You know, actually. I think, yeah. You know, acting.
Groucho, too.
Right? Yes. Groucho. It's an old comedic tradition. It's an old storytelling tradition. But also, I think, which is something that is a theme in my play, is that, you know, when it comes to show business, when it comes to acting, it's a combination of truth and a made-up story,
right?
Like you can't have comedy without truth. That you're laughing because there's a recognition there, and we can talk about this later. I do believe that Gracie Allen was probably the first method actor without realizing she was a method actor, which is interesting as well. But we can talk about that later. But back to this, George said that, you know, instantly she went on stage and he went, "You're the comic, you're the talent, and we're going to switch," you know, at the second show.
Yeah.
Not at all. There's Variety reviews where he's still holding on for dear life, and honestly, it makes sense. You know, if anyone is familiar at all with the story of George Burns, he started, you know, about like 8 years old, probably, you know, give or take, singing on street corners, and show business was his shul, his temple. He didn't want anything but to be in show business. But by 27, he was nowhere near the big time. He was not successful. He changed his name and his act over and over again so he could be rebooked, because they wouldn't know he was the same person. I think some of it's exaggerated a bit. I know he jokes that one time he just took someone's cards that they sold him.
Oh, so right. That was his name. Named himself after the business.
Yeah,
cards.
Which sounds plausible, honestly. Yeah. But the idea was that he was really desperately wanted to be in show business and wanted to be successful. And so it makes sense to me that he would hold on to being the comic, to being the lead, to being the funny one longer than he said he did. So that it does track to me, but it's hard to say, you know, based on reviews, because they didn't always get reviewed.
Yeah.
How long, but I would say probably based on what I found, I think about a year.
That's a very long time to not be too funny.
Yeah. And I think that he probably slowly maybe gave her some stuff, you know, like it wasn't overnight as most things are.
Yeah.
But to say that was one of the biggest surprises to me was considering he goes, "I knew it that night." And you're like, no, no, you didn't want, maybe you knew it, but you didn't want to let go, which is very human.
Yeah.
Right. You know?
Yeah.
And also understandable why when she retired, sort of jumping ahead a little bit, why he was so scared that he wouldn't be able to be successful without her, because he wasn't successful without her.
Yeah.
And when George met Gracie, he was literally doing imitations of big time acts. So he wasn't even, I mean, let alone, you know, with Gracie doing these sort of shticky joke books that, you know, everyone did, and he wasn't being original. When they met, she had a whole original act that, you know, they could have done, but it wasn't his thing. And here he was doing impressions of Jolson's act and trying to be something that he wasn't, which I think then, you know, came back in his life later on, which we'll talk about, when he had to work alone. I think he started doing an imitation of his own act with Gracie instead of finding the truth in his own act. And when he did, he won an Oscar.
Yeah. So let's talk about her, like her a bit.
Yeah.
You know, you spoke of method acting. So for those who don't know her, and this is like a bigger issue. This is more a hardball than a softball, and we can get to it. Her character is either dumb or crazy. I prefer to think of as she has her own system of logic.
Agreed. Which is what George would say. He called it illogical logic. Because if you really truly think about it, she's correct. She's just sort of on her own plane.
Yeah.
And I think that you can see that in, you know, Rose on The Golden Girls. You can see that in Phoebe on Friends.
Yeah,
it's very different. And something that was also interesting to me was you know, in my early research, I wasn't as familiar with the history of Dumdoras. I knew that Dumdora was a thing, but when I started my research, like decades ago, at the beginning, it was so interesting to see that it was really a trope, this Dumdora. But you could probably speak to this better than I can, but I feel what is fascinating between the difference between the regular sort of standard Dumdora and George and Gracie was that the traditional Dumdora seems very misogynistic to me. And I know that some people might disagree with me about George and Gracie. And listen, in some of their earlier stuff, he did sort of get very exasperated with her. You know, I see that in some of the shorts.
Uh-huh.
I get it.
And woman driver stuff, that kind of material.
But the big difference, I think, that really makes us remember them, I mean, obviously also the fact that they were on TV and radio helps, is because he treats her so respectfully.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure that has to do with the fact that George really did love her. So that, I'm sure, comes through.
Yeah.
But if you really think about what she's saying, she is rather smart. She's just seeing things on a completely different plane. It's malapropisms, right?
Right.
And whereas my understanding, because I don't have any footage to be able to look at, and Gracie actually was in a Dumdora act before she met George, which many people don't talk about, because her fiancé at the time was in a group, which you're familiar with them, right? I'm not as familiar with, Lee, right? His ex-wife? Ryan and Lee.
Oh, sure. I know I know the name, but not the act, really.
Gracie was engaged to a man called Benny Ryan, which is also interesting to me because, you know, if you read George's account, Benny Ryan wrote terrible songs, but Benny Ryan wrote Inky Dinky Doo, right?
Oh, sure.
I'm saying that
correctly.
That's
a great song.
the Mississippi song. He had a pretty good career and stability.
Yeah.
But George likes to talk about the bad songs, and that makes me laugh because he was jealous. He's still jealous of him, jealous of the man that almost married Gracie. Benny Ryan was either divorced from his wife, Lee, or when they were estranged. I don't really quite know the information because, you know, there isn't information on it. Gracie was stepping in to the act. So she was doing a Dumdora act with him.
And for the listeners, you know, there was a thing called a Dumdora act where the woman was, it's what it sounds like, the woman was dumb. And there were some other acts. Block and Sully was another one.
Oh, yes, Block and Sully.
And
yes, I forgot about that.
Bob Hope had his own one on radio.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, her name was Honey Child. And she was like a Southern Dumdora. And he, I think when he, you know, that's when he had his variety show on radio. But eventually she, you know, was.
But I guess what I'm getting at is that my understanding is that it was very much like, I'm the smart man and you are dumb.
Yes.
And I'm just going to lord it over
yes.
you. Whereas George and Gracie is, I'm confused by you. And eventually I love you and it's adorable.
Right. And he kind of gives in because he's kind of exhausted.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that you see sort of a tinge in the talkies.
Yeah.
The early shorts of him being exasperated with her, which I think is probably very much akin to what Dumdora was really like.
Yeah.
But when we get to really them even in the films, which is not that, you know, shortly after the shorts, if you think about it in terms of time, maybe in terms of technology, but not time, she's really looked at as a lovable character and not sort of this like dumb lady.
Right.
And I know that people like to just sort of categorize her as dumb because it is like she's supposed to be dumb and stupid. But if you really pay attention to what they're doing and you think about it.
Yeah.
Like it makes sense that if you put two turkeys or two chickens in the oven, when the small one is burnt, the large one is ready. It actually does make sense.
That's right. It's its own system. Here's a question born out of my having done far less research than you. I don't believe I've ever heard her out of character. So one question, I think one reason contemporary people might assume that she's playing a dumb or ditzy kind of character is because of her vocal range.
Yes.
And the sound, you know, the sound of her voice. And so I'm just kind of wondering, is part of that just how she talks?
That's a very good question. George claims that her onstage voice was slightly higher than her regular voice, but that it wasn't such a huge difference.
Right.
And I would say it's hard to really know what that means because there is no recording of her with her actual voice
that's
that
wild.
That I can think of.
Wow.
I think maybe if you watch the one of the last episodes in the last season when Gracie becomes smart, I feel like, and I don't know if it's just me because I'm also an actor, and so I've played Gracie in all of the readings of my play, and so I've really worked on her voice because I do think that many people get her voice wrong.
Yeah,
they play her like Adelaide from Guys and Dolls.
Right, exactly, exactly. And that's wrong. That's right.
And she's not. She's not even from New York. And so I think that people are confusing some of the old regionalisms in her voice because she was in vaudeville and hung out with a lot of New Yorkers probably.
Yeah.
But they're not New York sounds.
Right.
It's just an old-timey sound via San Francisco.
Right.
And her A's are very specifically not New York. And I think that if, I don't know, I don't want to put down anyone else's impression of her, right? But I think that most people just sort of put on a gangster mole.
Right.
And don't actually pay attention to what she sounds like.
Yeah. And that's what I wanted to, you know, the thing you said so aptly about her being the first method actor or whatever. She's really just acting with George. She's just speaking matter-of-factly, kind of. She's not putting on a dumb thing.
No, and she really had to believe it, which was why later in the series the show became so hard for Gracie when she was getting older and having heart issues. It was very hard to memorize all of those lines because she had to make it make sense to her to be able to memorize it. And
right.
I think any actor could say, yeah, like if it's harder to make it make sense, it's harder for me to, you know, be able to memorize it. But I guess digressing a bit, but I think more to answer your question, Gracie never did the same joke the same way.
Interesting. Yeah.
She never did it the same way she did it in rehearsal, which I think a lot of people are like that too. Like George says that it wasn't until she was on stage that he realized how funny she was. But I think a lot of actors, sometimes it's the audience that sort of, you know, brings them out. I think this is a little bit different than that, even though she had that.
Yeah.
I think this is the idea of, she was really in the moment and really had to believe it. And when she had to teach Carol Channing how to play her in scenes with George when she retired, that's what she really tried to explain to her, was you just have to pay attention and listen to what he say and react to what he's saying.
Yeah.
Even some of the directors would say, you know, oh, well, you need to cheat towards the camera. And she didn't understand that. Well, why? I don't eat breakfast that way. Why would I do that? And I don't think that she meant it in a rude way or in a I'm a temperamental actress. I think that she just seriously was like, well, I'm in the moment. I'm acting. Maybe she didn't use those words per se, but reading everything about the way that she presented herself, which is really the way you should do comedy, right?
Yeah.
And acting in general, because when you're in the moment, things are new. You know, there's the Meisner technique where, you know, you do this exercise where you just say the same word in different ways,
because
you can say no three different ways and have three different intentions behind it. George also talked about that if you forgot a line, she would leave the stage, go in the dressing room and take her makeup off. Actually physically did that, I don't know. But he said, you know, if you didn't grab her with the next line, she would leave because that's where she was supposed to go. She was exiting and she didn't hear the line. She would just go. Well, and I kind of love her for that.
So you mentioned her coming from San Francisco. So for folks who don't know, Gracie was Irish and came from a sister act with her four sisters, the Five Colleens, right?
Yes.
And she's West Coast, and George is from the Lower East Side. She's from a showbiz family, and he's from a working class family.
Yeah, parents were immigrants.
And so it's she's Irish, he's Jewish, and it's kind of like the AB's Irish Rose cultural dichotomy.
Very much so, which I think at that time was probably the first time that a lot of cultures like that were coming together. And I think it's maybe hard for people these days to understand how different and taboo that probably was at the time. I think maybe less so for show business folk, because that was one of the only opportunities that they were allowed to do. You know, the Irish and the Jewish were, you know, definitely seen as lower than in certain respects.
Yeah, so they had that in common, kind of.
Yeah, which I'd love to talk about in a little bit. There's one of my favorite interviews with Gracie is a very early interview where she is herself.
Oh.
And one of the things she says in this is that she is always thought, not always, but very often confused to be Jewish.
Huh.
I think she implies that it might be because she's with George.
Yeah.
But she also tends to, I don't have the article in front of me. It's in my big vault of research. But I also think it really implies the fact that because of the world that she's in.
Showbiz.
And even to this day. Yeah. And even to this day, there was someone on Instagram who referred to her as their one of their favorite Jewish comedians. And I was like, no, very much no. You know, I thought that at least by now that they were known as that sort of dichotomy, right? You know, that Stiller and Mira, right? I think that's sort of the last of that sort of, you know,
totally.
Kind of, you know, taboo comedy. You know, I don't want to digress. People aren't familiar with Stiller and Mira, but you should. That was sort of their shtick for a while as well.
Yeah.
Much more than George and Gracie. But anyway, that was interesting to me in that interview for her to say, oh, yeah, a lot of people just assume I'm Jewish.
And I think they were probably pretty both. Not too religious, right? I think they were.
Gracie was.
Oh, she was. She was more religious.
But not in the sense that I think, you know, would stop her from marrying George, if that's what you mean. But in comparison to George, she was.
Yeah, I recall. And in fact, when I picked a little picture to sort of advertise that this momentous centennial was coming up, I found a great picture that illustrated in a clearer way than I'd ever seen before. The little trivia tidbit I knew that she had different colored eyes.
Yes.
And then you mentioned her bad heart. There were other anomalies too, right? Didn't she have like several weird anomalies?
Two accidents that happened when she was quite young. One, she pulled a scalding pot of hot water off of the stove when she was very small.
Yeah.
And it burned her entire arm. It's hard to know exactly where it ends, but because of the quarter sleeves, I'm going to say it's about a quarter, you know?
Wow.
Which is why she wore those, if anyone is familiar with her, they're not long, long sleeves, right? They're like quarter sleeves. And it became sort of her signature. And when she, at her biggest popularity, those kind of dresses became quite popular, you know, no one ever knowing.
Yeah.
George says that she was never able to really straighten the arm.
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure if that's true, but if you watch a lot of her, particularly in the later seasons of the TV series, when they would do the tags at the end in front of the audience, she puts her hand in her pocket.
Ah.
And I think that that's because she can only bend it.
Yeah.
So that to me makes me think that he is not just exaggerating, that she couldn't actually, you know, do that.
Well, it seems plausible.
Yeah. And she was very insecure about it. I think some of the only people who ever saw it were close family. I know Joan Benny mentions she saw it while she was swimming, you know, so she felt comfortable in front of family friends and family's children. But it made her very, very insecure. And I don't know if it was, you know, chicken and the egg, right? She was someone who was very concerned about her appearance. Everything, she wanted to look perfect, you know, perfect dress, perfect hair. It may also just be a show business thing.
Yeah, no, yeah, it feels like she's very, like, she's kind of a glamour puss. Always.
Definitely. And I'm fine with that because I'm a glamour puss, but so I can relate. But also at the time when she started doing her act with George, you know, there were more sort of costumes for characters, right?
Yeah.
And she just wanted to wear a nice dress on stage. And people were like, well, what do you mean? You're not going to like wear the same thing each time? She's like, no, I'm just going to wear what I'm wearing, like a really nice dress because I like nice dresses. I don't understand. I just want to, you know, or like, why did you wear a hat tonight or carry a purse? And, you know, a lady always carries a purse. Like, why do you need a purse on stage? But I think that goes back to the fact that to her, it was a street corner act, right?
Yeah. And
she was just walking on the street and she runs into this guy and they start chatting. So of course she'd have a hat and gloves and a purse.
It makes all the sense in the world. And the audience is probably not thinking that consciously, but it's hitting you on a subconscious level. It's creating that space.
Yeah. Well, most people, you know, who innovate don't realize they're innovating.
Yeah.
And George once described Gracie and Jack Benny like Edison.
Yeah, because they're such originals.
Exactly, and that they sort of created a template that then, whether people know it or not.
Yeah, right.
You may not like Chekhov, but most of the stuff that you enjoy have been influenced by Chekhov.
Right,
and so forth. I mean, the best pipeline example, not talking about Gracie, I think, is the people right now in late night who are influenced by David Letterman.
Right.
Letterman's hero was Johnny Carson.
Right.
Johnny Carson influenced generations and generations of comedians.
Right.
His idol was Jack Benny.
And I would say like Carson would have been influenced by like Benny and Bob Hope, people like that.
Yes. Well, Benny particularly was his absolute hero.
Yeah,
so
totally.
To say that Jack Benny still doesn't have influence today would be incorrect.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's almost like a relay race.
Yeah. And I'm excited to at one point go to the Comedy Museum, because my understanding is that they do things like that. They have you put in a computer your influences
right.
in comedy, and then it shows you who influenced them. And then all of a sudden you get to learn about people in comedy you didn't know about.
Oh, it's wonderful. I got to go a few years ago.
Oh, you did? No. Oh, I can't wait.
It's wonderful. Yeah. The only thing that made me tear up for whatever reason was Bob Hope's like flak jacket from when he toured with the USO. I don't know why, but it just felt really like, wow, that felt like history, you know?
I just saw that they have a Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner's chairs when they would watch TV together. And that I was like, that's going to make me cry. Even though it's like not technically part of comedy history, it'll make me cry.
We're weird, Lauren.
We are. So are the people listening. So we're all weird together. Another issue where a dropped or knocked over kerosene lamp, the glass from the lamp got in her eye.
Wow.
Now, what's interesting is that George attributed that to the reason that she had two different color eyes. But more likely, she had something called, and I hope I say this correctly, it's called heterochromia. Which is when you're born with two different color eyes, and she had one green eye and one blue eye. And if you see any drawings of her on the cover of magazines, people were known to be mindful of that. She didn't want people to know that she had that issue. She's very insecure about it, among other things, including the arm. George said that she had trouble with her eyesight because of that, or trouble with her eye. He attributed mostly to the reason that she had migraines, as well as thinking that that was why she had two different color eyes, which is obviously not true. I could see why he might have thought that the migraines were caused by that, but we, of course, can't know. I am not a doctor, but I do think that the migraines were more likely precursor to the fact that she already had a heart issue.
Oh.
I don't know all of her medical information. She may have just developed this heart issue when she was older. I know that often people with heart issues can also have migraines. Not that all people with heart issues have migraines, but that was something that was very interesting to me. Often Gracie would have to sit in a dark room with a cold compress over her head and no noise at all. I mean, they were really, really bad migraines. But if she had a show, she kind of pushed through it. I don't know how, but she did.
So George, this palpable thing, he really, really, really seemed in love with her and to love her. Can you speak to, I mean, she clearly loved him as well, but it's not quite as vocal. She seemed content to be adored by George.
I don't know about that. I think that the problem is that when someone passes away 20 odd years before you do, and then you become a superstar on your own, those left are the ones telling that history is made by those, you know, who won.
Yeah.
And not saying that he won, but, you know, he's the one left to tell the story.
Yeah.
And his story is, I adored her.
Yeah.
And she's the only reason that I'm here talking to you.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't say that Gracie didn't love him, but also, like, we just don't know all of the details because she can't speak for herself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's hard for me to say, right? Like, I can speak of some, particularly this early interview that I was speaking of, that I was just such a gem to find. And when I originally found it, it's from the World Telegraph in the 1930s. Their daughter had just been born. It was not on microfiche or microfilm. It was falling apart in my hands. I don't know why the Performing Arts Library has mostly clippings when I was there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that I could have found it somewhere else as a microfilm if I needed it. But, you know, to step up and then have to dust off your lap, crumbling articles.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's expensive and time consuming to get everything scanned. So they have to prioritize.
Yeah. But I'm sure it's still out there somewhere.
Yeah.
But what I get from that article is she's not necessarily talking about her affection for George, but I think you can see it in the way that she treats him. And what I appreciate is that it's not just like, oh, I adore you and I'm being adored, right? They have a partnership, you can tell.
Yeah.
Particularly, George starts talking about they recently went with the Bennies through Europe and Russia, and they took this big tour, and he starts exaggerating a little bit, and she lets him know, well, that's not actually what really happened. And, you know, and I think at one point, which is one of my favorite things, is he goes, I'm sorry when I tell stories, I act things out, use my hands. And these are terrible quotes, but, you know,
yeah,
pretty much that he gets very active when he tells stories. And Gracie goes, unless you haven't noticed already. Which is so beautifully, I think I may have gasped when I read it, because we don't know that about her, right? We don't know that she ribbed him or that they had this sort of, you know, loving back and forth. You assume that, like, he adored her and then she just basked in that. And I think that that sort of moment is this beautiful testament of what their relationship was probably like.
And it's very real. It's very not her character. Yeah, right.
It's very real. Yeah. So this article from 1934, because that's around the time that Sandra was born, because Gracie, the interviewer notices that she spends half the time looking out the window waiting for her daughter to come back from the park, which is very sweet. But as early as that, she talks about wanting to retire.
Wow.
Which I think will surprise people. Yeah. And she pretty much says that to her, it's a job.
Right.
She doesn't mean she doesn't enjoy it.
Right.
But it was a job. It was the family business.
Yeah.
She goes to work every day. And if she had the money, she would retire tomorrow. That she has no interest in doing Shakespeare.
As opposed to George, who did it until he was 100 years old and like the last second.
Yeah. And I think that she knew that. And I think that there's a lot of proof, and many people would agree, that she would have retired much earlier from the television show.
Yeah.
If she wasn't afraid of what it would do to him, which also shows how much she loved him.
Right.
She put her own health and her own happiness in place of his because she was so worried that it might kill him, like literally. And I think that that's,
do you know, you know,
could be a legitimate thing. He loved it that much, you know?
Yeah. Do you know Blossom Seeley and Benny Fields?
Yes.
So something very similar. She was the star of the two of them, and she retired for a while to let him get the limelight for a while. Well, that was more like, it was a little different, but it's a similar act of self-sacrifice, you know, like in a different way. She stepped back and let him have the limelight. So I feel like she retired, and then it wasn't very long before she passed away, right? I mean, how many years was it?
Yeah, she retired in, what, 58, right?
Uh-huh.
And then she died in 64?
I think it's something like that, 64.
Everyone's going to be like, you're supposed to be the historian. I don't have the dates in front of me.
Yeah, but I remember that it was like in the mid-60s because it was around the time that Sophie Tucker died. Sophie Tucker died in 64. 66.
Well, the reason that I also remember is because of the stories. He talks about that the summer that she passed away, they were watching the tribute to JFK at the convention.
Oh, wow.
Because she died in August.
Yeah. And also I recall him... from around the same time of his solo efforts too. So,
yes, but you know, he really wasn't successful at that until Jack Benny died.
No,
and a lot of that, what is, I think, you know, based on what the research that I've done, is he couldn't let go of the idea that of what had made him successful.
Yeah,
which is the death of art, right? And and also the death of living.
Yeah,
which is why I think it's sort of a beautiful metaphor that, like, if you won't grow, if you won't embrace new things, if you, you know, hold on to something that isn't you or isn't working anymore, or doing an imitation of your life instead of moving forward, there is no moving forward. There's only stagnation.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. Right. So that was the rut he was in until he did.
Yeah. And like, I don't think he really understood it because he just.
Yeah.
He wanted it so badly. And I get that. And one of the things that I also think, sort of going back a little bit, that sets Burns and Allen as a Dumb Dora apart, even though we don't have any real footage of what the original Dumb Doras were, is the fact that a lot of Gracie's comedy is based on malapropisms. And a lot of that George talks about he got from his mother, who English was not her first language.
Right, right.
And so he would see her make these sort of mistakes. And I think a lot of it also may be Yiddish cadences as well. Mm-hmm. But when I first discovered Burns and Allen, I read the book first before seeing any of their act, which is insane. I mean, I knew who they were, right? You know, I'd probably seen clips. I loved the Paley Show clip shows. Oh my God. I mean, just a little bit about how I first really sort of became obsessed with them was my history teacher let us pick a topic for every decade of the 20th century. So I picked television. I found something and I remember going, oh yeah, I need to read that book, or, you know, I need to learn more about them. Literally remember going to the Carge catalog. And there being a copy of Gracie on the top of the card catalog, which is crazy because it had not just come out. Don't know why it was there.
Synchronicity.
It was really insane that it was there, because looking at the dates, I'm like, that hardcover book came out years ago. But I digress. So I was like, you know, after I finish this project, I'm going to read this book. It wasn't like I didn't know who they were. I just wasn't immersed in it. I maybe didn't remember some of the stuff. I maybe seen a clip from a TV show.
Well, same.
I was more familiar with Jack.
Yeah, same. She died before I was born, and their shows weren't on, and I certainly wasn't listening to old time radio in the 1970s and 80s.
I
probably heard some old time radio clips when I was a kid, but
I remember when I read the books, when I read Gracie, A Love Story, and I read the comedy, which I think, you know, that kind of comedy is perfect to read, but there's something about, like, when I read Who's On First for the first time, I feel like I saw more of the genius of it than just watching clips of
it, even though
it's brilliant. Yeah. I remember reading it and going, and maybe it's because you see the whole thing on the page as opposed to clips, but I was like, this is brilliant. But anyway, back to George and Gracie. I remember going, wow, this is the kind of humor a dyslexic can understand. I am dyslexic. I didn't know that George was dyslexic. I didn't know that for years that he was dyslexic.
Wow.
And so my brain went, oh, I get this.
That would be a good talk in and of itself, Lauren.
It really is. I mean, if you look at, there's one particular joke sequence that they used a lot that is in the shorts, which is confusing the sounds of words with the letters that they actually start with.
Right, right.
That is 100% a dyslexic joke.
Right.
He doesn't know it's a dyslexic joke.
Right.
But that's what dyslexics do. Dyslexics can't hear phonemes, which are the non-complex sounds that make up words. So we read phonetically.
Right, and which can result in errors that people might find comical.
Exactly. Yeah. I find them comical. I actually collect dyslexic jokes. I think dyslexic jokes are hilarious. I only have a handful of them, but and most of them are written by dyslexics. George, I think, found that he was dyslexic in his 90s, you know, and they asked him, you know, what it meant now. And he says, it doesn't really change anything. I still can't spell it. Which is like, yeah, it really doesn't. But it's that kind of humor. It's hearing things and misunderstanding, and that's malapropisms. And I think that he maybe didn't give himself enough credit at that time, at least, that, and even though, listen, I'm not discounting the fact that, you know, they had a lot of ghostwriters when they were in vaudeville, and that, you know, he had a huge team of writers.
Yeah.
But you can see that that is specifically his sense of humor, and he talks about how he just for some reason keyed into that stuff with his mother, for instance, with other people. And I went, oh, I feel that. That's dyslexic humor.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
He had to realize, I think, that he really was a comic genius and he didn't need her. Now, that being said, some of the jokes he used when he was older are Gracie jokes, but it's okay. but George Burns was known as a comics comic, right?
Yeah.
You know, something that comedians really liked. And a lot of that was because he would sort of do his act, which eventually became his act, at parties.
Right.
And everyone would love it. But he didn't think that that was something that he could really sort of do. And he was encouraged by George.
Right.
Yeah. And I think he was encouraged to do that more by Gracie and then eventually by Jack, to just sort of be himself.
And it worked beautifully on talk shows.
Yeah.
And you use that word so aptly in the title of your show, The Raconteurs, because that's kind of like, it becomes a great act.
And it's a talent to be able to talk like that and tell stories. And like I said at the beginning, you know, to tell the same story maybe three different ways, and it's still interesting. You're like, oh, I've heard this one. Oh, he changed the finish. Okay, you know, or he did this, or he added a word, or, you know, changed the story a bit to make it more romantic. I recently saw on Wiki that it says they were married on the stage of the palace. I have never heard that.
Oh, I may have, but forgot it. Oh, and here's something else. Things about Gracie. She was the first female host at the Palace Theater.
Yes, she was.
And I think she did some radio without George, right?
She did, particularly at the beginning.
Yeah. And also, folks, they're among the first, you know, they got into radio very early.
Yes. And funny enough, when they tried to get into radio at first, they were told that her voice was too high for radio.
That's like the
which
people,
George was
like
so
turning
bitter
down
about.
The Beatles.
Yeah, for years he was still sort of, you know, I think he tells the story, don't know if this is real, but I've only heard it once, so that makes me think it is, that he told a story in one of the books that he saw the executive and like gave him a talking out to or something. I can't remember which book that was in, but, you know, he definitely held a grudge. And she didn't want to go on by herself. And I think that half of it was nerves. You know, she was a person who was always nervous before she went on stage.
Yeah.
Which, listen, I think, you know, if you're not nervous, something's wrong probably.
Yeah.
A little bit. And also, I think she also was concerned to leave him behind.
Yeah, that was another thing I was thinking of. Yes, I mean, that really speaks to that. That above all, I think speaks to how much she loved him, because I mean, that's like the plot of so many of those old pre-code movies.
Right.
It's like you dump your partner, and when you get your opportunity and you become the star, the other partner is like,
it's kind of A Star Is Born, but without them being, you know, yeah, an act in the beginning. But that's a trope. Yeah.
Far more common to throw your partner over and take the opportunity than for somebody who's the bigger star to. And she, I know, also, let's face it, she wasn't really carrying him per se. He exaggerated that. He was a talented man.
He was that, yes, which I was saying is I think you had to realize that he was talented. But I have to say, if you watch some of the early shorts, he's not the best actor. he's a little uncomfortable, and she's much better than him. So, you know, it's interesting though, because, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Eddie Izzard's comedy, but she would say, she's also dyslexic, would say, you know, I've always been sort of, you know, like a fine wine. It takes me a while to like figure things out, and I'm behind everybody, but eventually I catch up. And I think a lot of dyslexics are a little like that, because we think a little outside the box.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's because we're ahead of other people and they have to catch up to us, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, when people think differently, it's like that whole idea of you're only as big as the biggest fish in the room, right?
Right.
You know, you're only as smart as the smartest person in the room.
Right.
I mean, I remember once being in a room where, before the internet, where no one believed me when World War II started. So you know what? I was the dumb one. I was right. But no one believed me that was when it started. So they were the smart ones and I wasn't. You know, it depends on what's happening, you know, around you. But yeah, I think that, you know, he might have been riding on her coattails a little bit at the beginning.
Yeah.
People are going to hate me for saying that, but we all learn, right? We're not, you know.
But also in the beginning, it was him writing the jokes before they could afford, I mean, he was stealing them from humor magazines and stuff.
Oh, you mean at the very, very beginning? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Before they could hire people like Al Boesberg and stuff.
That's what I was going to say. I was like, because I think that, you know, people say he wrote Lamb Chops, and I don't think he did.
No. Yeah. Boesberg wrote that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's attributed to both of them.
Yeah. Well, I think but ultimately, you know, when we're talking about, you know, they had a big writing staff. Well, ultimately it's coming to George's desk and he's deciding what's going to be in and what works.
Sure.
And,
listen, I don't want to say that I'm not saying that he wasn't funny and he didn't write jokes.
Yeah.
Because as I'm saying, the humor of Burns and Allen is George Burns's humor.
Yeah.
Based on his experience, based on the way he sees comedy. But being a great editor is also a talent.
For sure. Yeah.
You know, this is what showrunning has become, right? When George was doing those shows, there was no such thing as a showrunner, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
Now you have a showrunner where all of the scripts are filtered through that person, whether they, you know, are credited on the episode that they wrote or they start writing the episode that they wrote. Eventually, it has their imprint on it to make it the voice of the show. So exactly, to say that whether George wrote all the jokes or not on that staff, or, you know, because obviously there's different sections of their life.
Yeah.
And I do believe he wrote the jokes, just maybe not as much as he said he did. at the beginning, I mean.
Oh,
and
listen,
he was very good about, you know, talking about his writing staff.
Yeah.
And a little on top of that, you know, maybe it's not really where we're going, but I know that when I talk about some of the early interviews, I'll have people say, oh, well, there are these articles in the 50s where she's answering questions and she's talking about her life. Those were written by the staff of the show.
Yeah.
I have one article from like Women's Companion or something that feels a little in her voice,
yes,
you know, feels
right,
that some
right.
of it might be real. And that might be either because the stories are real.
Yeah.
Right. It's hard to tell because she, by the 50s, was very much about people only care about the character.
Uh-huh.
Which I think half probably, whether conscious or not, had to do with a sense of privacy.
Yeah.
That she didn't have, that she really sort of freaked her out about. And also just a self-conscious of like, oh, no one really cares about me.
So, Lauren, you know, maybe we should save some of this for the fall.
That's right. We probably should.
So, folks, this fall, we're calling it A Century of Burns and Allen, and we're going to have a little sequence of events and talks and screenings and performances to celebrate a century of this great comedy team. Some might be live, some might be online, and probably revisit a lot of these topics in more depth, maybe show some of their movies or listen to some of their radio. And we hope you'll join us for it.
I hope everyone will. I think that there's a lot of gems in the older stuff that I think people aren't as familiar with as they are with the television work. That is a lot of my favorite.
Right. And they know old George, but maybe not young George. Yes. With Gracie.
I would also say that I think that Gracie was smarter on the radio, which is a lot to say.
You mean, like in terms of thinking on her feet and live?
Yeah, I don't
situations.
Know. I think that, you know, when you come into a visual medium, it's less about, I don't want to insult anybody because they're both great. They're all great. I think a lot of the jokes became more visual.
Yeah. No, you can go ahead and say she's the smarter and better one.
Yeah, I don't know. I when I listen to the radio stuff, she seems smarter than she does, which is why I also love the episode in the final season when Gracie accidentally becomes smart because she's hypnotized.
There's a Laurel and Hardy movie like that too, when Laurel gets bonked on the head and becomes professorial.
It's really great. And you know, that's something that's wonderful now is that you can go online and you can watch the old show, or you can watch it on antenna TV, or you can listen to the radio shows. You know, when I was a kid, I had to go to the Paley Center or buy like a cassette.
I got, you know, when I was about 20 or, you know, maybe my late teens or something, Nickelodeon had Nick at Night, which was just this huge boon. And they showed a lot of old 50s sitcoms that I'd heard about and were legendary and had never seen before. And among them was Burns and Allen.
Oh, so I didn't remember that they showed that. I would not have. Because I definitely watched Nick at Night, but maybe by then it was gone. Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. So that was that's how I discovered Gracie.
Great.
Well, cool. I mean, do you have more stuff you want to?
No, I think that's good. I think you're right. I think we should save some of it. And people can listen to clips from my play, which is on this feed.
Excellent.
It's a full-length play. Absolutely looking for it to be produced. These are some of the clips from Act One that I thought would be interesting to record, like a radio show, because it really fits into them. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to more. I just, anytime I have a chance to introduce people to them makes me happy.
Same. All right. Well, thanks, Lauren. And happy Valentine's Day to everyone.
Thank you. Oh, should we tell them where to follow us on social media?
Oh, we should. We should indeed. Yes, you'll learn about all of these events. Well, I've got a blog called Travelanche, travsd.wordpress.com. So I'll be posting there. And Lauren?
I am at Lauren Milberger on Instagram and Twitter and all the rest. And you can find me there, usually talking about television or Burns and Allen. And we'll have updates there also, obviously, when we do our events.
Far out. Good say goodnight, Gracie.
Good night.
Oh, we didn't talk about that, right? The biggest misnomer. She never said say goodnight, Gracie. She just said goodnight. If one more person tries to tell me that, I don't know what to say. No.
Yeah, that must really, really drive you up the wall.
Yeah, that and people who don't believe that she's actually older than she said. But we'll keep that for next time. I have tons of proof. Okay. Bye.